The salon was the social center of the Queen of the West, a very shallow draft riverboat. Here, passengers could have a drink, take their meals, play cards, or simply engage in conversation. There were many more men on board than there were women, and the women passengers tended to gather in one corner to talk among themselves. The game Falcon joined had six players: Falcon, Cody, Ingram, and three others, all gold hunters. Reynolds, one of the card players, was a veteran of prospecting in the Bighorn Basin, and during the course of the game, he shared with the others some of the places they could look for gold.
Of course, I tell you this, but with a warning.
A warning about what?
About Indians.
Indians? But the Crow live here. They're friendly.
Yeah, I reckon they're supposed to be. We've been having a little trouble with them. They've killed a few prospectors, and here just recent, they killed a whole family. Husband, wife, and her little child.
Now, are you talking about the Kennedy family? That was mean to his horses, wasn't it?
No, sir, ain't talking about them. This was the Barlow family. And they lived right there along the Stinking Water River. And the closest Indians to them is Crow.
How do you know it was Indians who did it?
How do I know? Because they cut them up something awful. And they scalped them, too. Now, I've heard of white men killing people for to rob them and such. But I ain't never heard of no white man scalping other whites. Most especially if it be a woman and a child.
Ingram eyed his cards.
Has the army been called out?
Nah. People are taking care of it their own selves. Mr. Bellefontaine organized a posse, found some Indians off the reservation and killed a couple of them. Then they left a note letting the Indians know the two was killed because they didn't stay where they belong. And it told them there'd be more killing if the Indians got off their reservation again.
Bellefontaine did that? What right did he have to do something like that? Why didn't he take it to the army?
Now, I don't know why I didn't take it to the army. But seeing as Pert and I owns the entire town, I reckon that's about all the right he needs.
That evening, as the boat moved slowly but majestically down the river, Falcon, Cody, and Ingram stood out on the deck, enjoying the cool evening breeze and looking at the wake of paddle-wheel-churned water, breaking white, gleaming in the bright full moonlight. Falcon examined the moonlit bank sliding by. He saw a lot of deer coming down to the river to drink, amazingly unafraid of the huge, fire-bellowing, thundering monster moving down the river. He also saw elk, bighorn, and even a couple of bears come down to get a drink. Shortly after they crossed from Montana Territory into Wyoming Territory, they saw three Indians on horseback, high on an overlook as they watched the riverboat pass by on its downriver transit. Cody lit his pipe, and for a moment the flare of his match cast a golden glow on the faces of the three men. The puff of smoke was caught by the night air and drifted back over the churning paddle wheel where it was broken up.
I don't mind telling you that I have been giving a lot of thought to what Reynolds was talking about at our poker game this afternoon.
Do you believe him?
I don't have any reason not to believe him.
What do you know about this man, Bellefontaine?
Well, I know that we are going to be competitors. We'll be building Cody very close to where Damaris Springs is. And when the railroad extends this far, why, Cody and Damaris Springs will just naturally be in competition for it.
Is he the kind of man who would send out a posse on his own?
Cody paused for a moment before he answered.
Look, I don't want you to get me wrong here. I mean, I have already told you that Bellefontaine and I will both be competing for the railroad. So I don't want you to think that colors my assessment of the man. But to answer your question, yes, he is exactly the kind of man who would send out a posse on his own and not just for Indians. Reynolds was correct when he said that Bellefontaine owns the town. And he was also correct when he said that is all the right Bellefontaine thinks that he needs.
I may need to meet this man.
Oh, don't worry about that. You'll meet him.
As Ebersole suspected, Billy Taylor overheard the conversation that told him Falcon McAllister and Buffalo Bill were going to the Standing Rock Agency to talk to Sitting Bull. They met in a back alley in the wee hours of the morning.
Talk to Sitting Bull? Taylor, what the hell do they want to talk to that redskin for?
I don't know. I never heard the why of it, just the doing of it.
Then we need to get there.
How are we gonna do that? We didn't get no money at all from the train holdup.
We was holding up the wrong thing. What we need to do is hold us up a bank.
A bank? Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm serious. Banks have more money and they don't move.
Have you took a good look at the bank here in Bismarck? It's damn near like a fort.
We ain't gonna hold up the bank here. We're gonna hold up the bank in Tyson.
Tyson? Where the hell's that? I ain't never even heard of it.
It's a little town just about 30 miles south of the railroad track.
After a few more drinks, they were limited by the amount of money they had, Ebersole and the others left the saloon. Without being too obvious, they checked out the bank. Then they rode on out of town to find a place to camp out for the night. It was nearly noon when the five men returned to the town of Tyson. Even though it was midday, the town was quiet, festering under the sun. Few people were sitting or standing in the shade of the porch overhangs. Two old men played a game of checkers, and half a dozen onlookers followed the game intently. One or two looked up as Ebersole and the others rode by. Peters and Taylor stayed outside the bank, holding the reins of the horses. Ebersole, Hawkins, and Dewey went inside. There were no customers in the bank, just one teller. He looked up at him with a smile as they came in. Then, realizing he didn't know any of the men, he instinctively knew that this wasn't going to be good.
You know what we're here for, don't you, mister?
The bank teller nodded.
Let's have all the money you've got.
We don't have so much. Well, this is a very small town and a very small bank.
How much do you have?
$1,726.
Well, ain't that just fine now, because that's just exactly how much money we wanted. Hand it over. Put it in this bag I'm holding. Move it, Taylor.
Yes, sir.
I told Joe, son, you just learned a lesson. Never kick a horse apple on a hot day.
Huh? What?
Two men suddenly realized something was wrong.
What the hell's going on here?
I believe they're robbing the bank.
Yeah? Well, you ain't getting my money.
Dewey, Taylor, and Hawkins turned their pistols on the two men. Both of the customers went down.
You shot them!
And we're gonna shoot you if you don't hurry up.
With his hands shaking so that he could barely control them, the teller dropped the rest of the money into the sack Ebersole was holding.
There, that's it. That's all the money we've got.
Let's get.
Peters was holding the horse for him out front.
What happened? What was the shooting?
Don't worry about it. Let's just get out of here.
The bank teller came out the front door.
Bank hold up! And they killed Mr. Abbott and Mr. Nash!
Come on!
They made it out of town without any further incident. And because the town was too small for a marshal, there was no posse form to pursue them. Also, because the town was not serviced by telegraph wires, they knew that they would be able to be well in the clear before any news of the robbery got out. With a satchel of money, no one on their tail, Ebersole and his gang set out to hunt Buffalo Bill and Falcon. In the renegade Indian camp, Mean to His Horses cast a contemptuous eye over the newcomers.
You are Crow, Running Elk. You were with Custer in the fight at Greasy Grass.
We weren't with Custer. We were too young.
White Bull squared his shoulders.
And now we want to join our brothers, the Cheyenne, to fight against the white man.
Why do you turn now against your masters?
They are not my masters.
Nor are they mine. They have killed our people for no reason.
And now your blood runs hot and you want to kill them?
Yes!
Why should I trust the Crow?
Have you not talked with the spirits? Have they not told you that we are all brothers? Have they not told you that the white man will be driven away and that the land they took will be ours?
Mean to His Horses stared at the two young Crow Indians before him for a long moment. Then he nodded.
You may stay.
Although Mean to His Horses had accepted Running Elk and White Bull into his camp, when he went out on his first raid after their arrival, he ordered them to stay behind. White Bull and Running Elk watched the raiding party ride off. They were angry they had not been included.
Why should we be left behind?
Perhaps we have to earn his trust.
Well, perhaps. We should prove ourselves to him.
How can we prove ourselves if we are not allowed to go with him?
I will find a way. You will see.
The Occidental Hotel in Sheridan, Wyoming Territory, was on North Main. A fine log structure, the hotel was built by Charles Buell. It advertised itself as the finest hostelry establishment between Chicago and San Francisco, and the boast was not without some justification. The lobby of the hotel was well-appointed with overstuffed sofas and chairs, a dark blue carpet, and several brass spittoons. A chandelier and a few strategically placed lanterns provided some light, but not brightness. The desk clerk looked up from his work as Cody, Falcom, and Ingram approached.
Buffalo Bill Cody! I heard you taking passage on the Queen of the West. How wonderful to see you again.
Hello, Paul. May I introduce my two friends? This is Falcon McAllister.
Oh, yes, indeed. I've heard much about you, sir, and all of it flattering.
And this gentleman is a writer who we can't seem to get rid of. His name is Prentice Ingram.
Prentice Ingram? The Prentice Ingram?
You have heard of me?
Oh, indeed I have, sir. And I've read every one of your books. In fact, I have one here that I would ask you to autograph for me, if you would be so kind.
Why, I would be delighted to autograph your book for you.
Ingram beamed in delight over the unexpected recognition. The clerk reached under the check-in counter and pulled out a copy of Buffalo Bill's spy trailer, The Stranger in Camp. He handed it to Ingram.
Mr. Cody, I saw in the newspaper that you're going to be holding auditions for your show. Up in Cinnabar, I believe?
Indeed I am. How about it, Paul? Do you want to try out for the show?
Well, not unless you have a place in your show for hotel clerks.
The clerk turned toward a board filled with keys hanging from hooks, took three of them down, and placed them on the counter.
These rooms are on the second floor near the front. All three are together. Two of them are adjoining rooms, and the third one is immediately across the hall.
Thanks. Ingram finished signing the book and handed it back to the clerk.
Thank you, sir. I will treasure this.
After settling their luggage into the room, Falcon, Cody, and Ingram decided to take a turn around the town to see what it was like. The reason I wanted to look over the town is because I expected Cody will be much like this town. After all, Mr. Beck founded and built this town, and he is the principal architect for Cody, which is to be built some 50 miles west of here. The town was well laid out, not only with a fine hotel, but many other conveniences a town would need. A mercantile, a leather goods store, a feed and seed store, a hardware store, a butcher store, a livery, a gun shop, and of course a saloon. In this case, the saloon was called the North Star Saloon, and it was a rather substantial building. Unlike many of the others, it was painted a gleaming white. Buffalo Bill Cody had been to the town of Sheridan many times over the last few years, and he knew several of the people who were at the moment patronizing the saloon. Gentlemen, meet my friends, Falcon McAllister and Prentice Ingram. Nearly all had heard of Falcon and Prentice Ingram, much to the delight of Ingram, who enjoyed sharing stories of both his books and his adventures. Gentlemen, what's the news
of
the Indian...
What did you just say, goddammit?
Don't do that!
Don't tell me what to do, whore! I done bought you four drinks! You say I can't lie in your bed?
I'm a bar girl, I'm not a prostitute!
She's right, Slayton. Lucy's no soiled dove. None of them girls here are. If you want that kind of woman, you need to go down the street to the cribs.
Don't you tell me where to go, barkeep. Don't tell me she ain't no whore.
He drew his hand back and turned toward Lucy.
You are gonna lie with me, or I'm gonna beat you to a pulp.
Mister, back away from the lady.
Say what?
Slayton was nearly as big a man as Falcon. He didn't have a beard, but neither was he clean-shaven. He had what looked like a five-day stubble. The most noticeable thing about him was his teeth. They were irregular and yellow. One front tooth was broken, and the one next to it was missing.
I said back away from the lady. Now.
Slayton turned toward Falcon and pointed at him.
Mister, you are butting in where you got no call. Now my advice to you is to sit down and mind your own business.
And you, mister, you might want to rethink.
Really? What is it I need to rethink?
Your entire attitude.
Oh, don't you be worrying none about my attitude. If there's anyone in here that needs to be rethinking, it's you for butting in where you got no business. You being a stranger to town, you may not know that I ain't the kind of man you want to mess with.
He had been pointing at Falcon, but now he started to drop his arm.
Don't drop your arm. Don't you make a move.
What?
You heard me.
Mister, you don't even have a gun in your hand. You think you can run a bluff on me? Nobody runs a bluff on me.
Oh, friend. I have known Falcon McAllister for some time now. And I don't believe I have ever seen him run a bluff.
I don't believe that is Falcon McAllister.
Slayton started to drop his arm. No sooner did he twitch than he found himself staring at the black hole of the business end of Falcon's pistol.
I told you not to move.
No! Wait!
Slayton put both arms up.
Don't shoot, mister! Don't shoot!
The room held its breath. Unable to control the sudden twitch that started in his left eye, Slayton looked around the saloon to see if he could count on anyone for help.
Oh, you people! You just gonna let him get away with this? He's a stranger! I'm one of you!
You ain't never been one of us, Slayton. You ain't done nothing but run roughshod over the rest of us ever since you got here. As far as I'm concerned, he can shoot you right now, and I'd say good riddance.
Slayton looked back at Falcon, realizing now that he was not only on his own, but he had come up against someone who was far his superior.
Please, mister. What are you going to do?
Yes, Falcon. What are you going to do?
Well, what do you think, Buffalo Bill? Think I should just shoot him and be done with it?
Oh, my God. Falcon McAllister, I am Buffalo Bill.
Oh, I tell you what. Falcon, suppose you put your pistol back in your holster. I'll count to three, then both of you can draw. A duel to the death like that would make a much better story than if I wrote that you merely shot him. Now, you'd like that better, wouldn't you, Slayton? I mean, if Falcon McAllister put his gun away and actually gave you a chance to draw against him, it wouldn't be much of a chance, I admit, but it would be a chance. Better than him just shooting you here now.
Yes.
Falcon put his pistol back in his holster.
I mean, no! No!
Slayton quickly held both his arms out in front of him, palms facing outward.
I don't want to draw against you at all. I ain't going for my gun. You see? I ain't going for my gun.
The young woman was tending to her bleeding lip, and she looked up at Slayton. One of her eyes was black and nearly swollen shut.
If it was left up to me, I would tell you to shoot him.
No!
Slayton began shaking uncontrollably, and then he wet his pants.
Please don't kill me. I swear, I'll never touch a girl again. Please don't kill me.
Lucy turned to the others in the saloon.
Did you all hear the promise Mr. Slayton just made?
We heard it, Miss Lucy.
Will you see to it that he keeps his promise?
Oh, he'll keep his promise all right. Because if he don't keep it, me and some of the boys will find him. We'll string him up ourselves.
Go home, Mr. Slayton. And don't come back here until you know how to behave around a lady.
Behave around a lady? What do you mean around a lady?
Once again, Falcon was holding his pistol pointed at Slayton.
Are you gonna try and say that you don't see any ladies around here?
What? No, I see a lady.
Slayton looked around at the other bar girls.
I see a lot of ladies around here.
Still holding his hands out in front of him, as if warding Falcon off, Slayton started to leave.
Wait a minute.
Slayton stopped Gold.
Before you leave, shuck out that gun belt. The pistol stays here.
Oh, well, who the hell says that it stays here?
I say it.
Slayton paused a moment longer, then, with shaking hands, unbuckled his gun belt, let it drop to the floor.
Now you can go.
When do I get it back?
Whenever the lady says you can have it back.
Are you crazy? I ain't leaving my gun with no whore!
I will give it back to you, Mr. Slayton, when you have learned to behave like a gentleman.
Falcon picked up the gun and belt Slayton had shed. Carrying it across the room, he placed it on the bar.
It might be a good idea to empty the bullets before you hand the pistol back to him. Someone with a temper like he has is liable to start shooting the moment he gets his hands back on it.
Don't you worry none about that, Mr. McAllister. I'll have his gun in before you can say Jack Sprat.
Johnny.
Yes, Miss Lucy?
Would you please pour these three gentlemen a drink on me?
Yes, ma'am, I'd be glad to.
Johnny reached for the house's finest bourbon.
But you're only going to pay for half of it. I'm paying the other half my own self.
For the most part, there was harmony between the white troopers of the 6th Cavalry and the black troopers of the 9th Cavalry at Fort Keogh, primarily because there was in effect a self-imposed segregation. The black troops stayed with their own, as did the white troops. There were some points of interaction, though, and at one of these points, the post-quartermaster, there was discord between Sergeant Major Moses Coltrane of the 9th Cavalry and Sergeant Lucas D. Pro of the 6th Cavalry. Both were supply sergeants for their respective units, and though their ranks were equal, Sergeant D. Pro assumed more power than he actually had, using as his authority the fact that he was white. The two men shared the same office in the supply room, each having a desk. D. Pro was already at his desk when Sergeant Major Coltrane came in.
My, you're here early today, Sergeant?
D. Pro, who was making entries in a ledger, nodded.
I had some extra work to do, so I came in early. I know that isn't anything your people would ever consider. From what I've observed, you people never do one thing beyond what is absolutely necessary. You are the worst soldiers I've ever seen.
Sergeant Major Coltrane did not respond to D. Pro's baiting. He knew that even though there were more black troopers in the fort than white, the white soldiers had 10 times more delinquency reports and 20 times more incidents of absent without leave and desertion.
I see they haven't shipped in the blankets yet. I hope they get them here before winter.
Well, they probably shipped them all to Arizona where they don't need them.
In this, at least, the two sergeants were united. For the blanket shipment would benefit every soldier on the entire post, whether they were black or white. Coltrane walked back to the arms room. D. Pro looked up from his desk as Coltrane opened the arms room door. Putting his pen down, he waited for the expected reaction.
Hey, what happened?
What happened to what?
The weapons! The carbines, rifles, and pistols we were shipping to Jefferson Barracks. I had them right here, all boxed up, ready to go.
I took care of that for you.
Coltrane came back from the arms room and stood right across from D. Pro's desk.
What do you mean you took care of it, Sergeant D. Pro? Those arms belong to the 9th Cavalry. I was in charge of shipping them back.
They belong to the Army, not to the 9th Cavalry. And we're in the same Army. At least that's what you're always telling me, ain't it? That we belong to the same army?
Yeah, but that don't give you the right to interfere with my work. Shipping those weapons out was my job. I'm responsible for them. Now they're gone, and I don't have any documentation for them.
Oh, relax. I knew you wouldn't be able to handle it, so I handled it for you. I had them sent by freight wagon to the railhead at Rawlins. I've got a hand receipt from the shipping office of the wagon freight and a bill of lading from Union Pacific that says they are on their way to Jefferson Barracks.
Where are they?
Oh, I told you, they're on their way to Jefferson Barracks.
No, I mean, where are the documents you were talking about? The hand receipt and the bill of lading? Where are they? If I'm responsible for the arms shipment, I need some proof that the job was done.
Are you questioning me?
Yeah, I'm questioning you. I told you I'm responsible for them, and I remain responsible for them no matter who arranged to have them shipped. That's why I want the hand receipt and the bill of lading.
You might have been responsible for it, but I'm the one who done the actual shipping, so if anything comes up, I'll be the one in trouble, not you. That's why I intend to keep the paperwork my own self.
Coltrane stared at D-Pro for a moment longer. He knew that by rights he should have the paperwork, since the weapons had been on the property books of the 9th Cavalry. But he knew, too, that if the question went to Major Benteen, for all that he was commander of the 9th, Benteen would back up the white NCO over Coltrane.
All right, Sergeant. As long as we have proof that the weapons were shipped, I guess it doesn't really matter who has it.
At lunchtime, Coltrane left the supply room and headed for the mess hall. Crossing the quadrangle, he saw Major Benteen going into the officers' mess. Coltrane started toward him.
Major Benteen?
Benteen stopped and turned toward him, the expression on his face showing his displeasure at being addressed.
What is it, Coltrane? What do you want?
It's about the weapons, Major. The ones we are supposed to be sending back to Jefferson Barracks.
Uh-huh. What about them?
They are gone, sir. Sergeant D-Pro says that he sent them.
Well, then that isn't your worry, is it?
No, sir. I suppose not, sir. Just thought I ought to tell you.
Well, you told me. Anything else?
No, sir. Nothing else.
Coltrane snapped a sharp salute. Later that same day, Sergeant Lucas D-Pro stepped up to Captain Gilmore's desk and saluted.
You wanted to see me, Captain?
Yes, Sergeant. I'm told by Major Benteen that you took charge of an arms shipment that by rights was the responsibility of the 9th Cavalry.
Yes, sir.
Why did you do that?
Captain, you know how them coloreds are. You can't depend on them for nothing. I figured I was doing the right thing by shipping them like I done.
How many were there?
40 Winchesters, 55 Springfields, and 35 Colt revolvers it was. All shipped back to Jefferson Barracks, Missouri.
That is a lot of weapons. Did they all get away all right?
Yes, sir. I got the bill of lading on file back in the arms room.
I don't know as I like you taking that responsibility. You work for me. And as Major Benteen pointed out, now that makes me liable for them in case something happens to them.
Ain't nothing gonna happen to them, Captain. Like as not, they're at Jefferson Barracks by now.
Whatever you do, Sergeant D-Pro, you make certain that you keep up with that bill of lading. We certainly don't want to wind up having to pay for it ourselves, do we, Sergeant?
No, sir, we sure don't. But don't worry, Captain. I'll keep up with the bill of lading.
After leaving Captain Gilmore's office, Sergeant D-Pro walked across the parade ground to an abandoned stable at the far end of the post property. The stable had been built 10 years earlier as a place to hold captured Indian horses until they could be shipped off to factories in the east to be made into glue. That policy was dropped 3 years ago, and the stable had been abandoned. Now, it was literally fallen down. Nobody ever came around it anymore, not only because it was so far away from the main area of the fort, but also because of the stench. Unlike the stables of cavalry horses, which were kept clean by constant mucking of the stalls, these stalls had never been mucked, even when the stable had been in use. Carefully walking through the building, D-Pro made for the stall most distant from the opening. He brushed away some of the hay, then he pulled back a tarpaulin. There were 8 boxes beneath the tarpaulin. Lettering on 2 of the boxes identified the contents as carbines repeating, caliber 30-30, 6 U.S. Cavalry. 3 boxes read, rifles breech loading, caliber 51, 6 U.S. Cavalry. Lettering on the remaining 3 boxes read, pistols, revolver, caliber 45, 6 U.S. Cavalry.
Yes, sir, Captain Gilmore. I'll keep up with the bill of lading for you.
Falcon, Cody, and Ingram rode the Sheridan and Yellowstone stage along with an attractive young woman and her 2 small children. The woman was Mrs. Juanita Kirby. Her 6-year-old son, one of his arms in a splint, was named Gary. And her 4-year-old daughter was named Abby.
Oh, wait until you see where we're going to build my town. It's the most beautiful area you have ever seen. It's very near Yellowstone Park.
I've been to Yellowstone. That is certainly a beautiful area.
Beautiful, yes. But strange, too. It's filled with boiling lakes and steam gushing from the ground, sometimes erupting into huge geysers that stream hundreds of feet into the air. And there's land you cannot walk on without fear of falling through into the very bowels of the earth. No, the land where my town will be built is nothing like that.
How close will it be to the place where we're going? What is the town called? Damaris Springs?
Yes, yes, Damaris Springs. Cody will be very close to where Damaris Springs is now, and there is no doubt in my mind but that Cody will so overtake Damaris Springs in development and desirability that Damaris Springs will cease to exist.
If I may, Mr. Cody, I'm afraid Mr. Bellefontaine may have something to say about that.
I'm sure he will, madam.
Do you know Mr. Bellefontaine?
Yes, my husband is a mining engineer and he works for Mr. Bellefontaine. For now?
For now?
Yes. My husband has been offered employment in the lead mines back in Missouri. And with the recent Indian incidents, he has decided to accept the offer. And frankly, Mr. Bellefontaine is not the most pleasant of men.
Suddenly, an arrow embedded itself in the stagecoach, less than an inch away from the window opening where Falcon would sit. Looking through the window, Falcon saw several mounted Indians galloping toward the coach. Even as he saw them, he also saw several arrows in flight streaming in the same direction.
Indians!
Falcon opened the door of the stage.
Where are you going? On top! I'll be in better position to shoot from up there!
Good idea! I'll join you! Ingram, you stay with Mrs. Kirby and the children.
I'll do that!
The shotgun rider showed pure relief as Falcon and Cody clambered to the top of the stage.
Good to see you boys coming up here!
Falcon leaned over to the driver.
Bo, keep the team running as fast as you can!
If we go any faster, we're gonna start flying!
Falcon and Cody laid on their stomach on the coach. With their first shot, they dropped two of the attackers. The shotgun guard got one too, and as one of the Indians galloped up alongside the stage, Ingram shot. Then Falcon got another. The Indian renegades were led by none other than Mean to his horses himself. He saw five of his warriors fall in the first few minutes of their attack, including the only other Indian carrying a rifle. That was half his band. He called a halt to the chase.
They're peeling off! He's up on the horse! Oh! Oh!
Bo hauled back on the reins as he also put his foot on the brake. The stagecoach slowed to a stop. The driver turned to his shotgun rider.
Hank, keep an eye open in case them heathens decide to come back. After a run like this, I'd better check out the harness.
All right, Bo.
Hank held his rifle at the ready and searched the road behind him. Falcon and Cody climbed down from the top of the stagecoach as well. On the ground, Falcon opened the doors to the coach and looked inside. Mrs. Kirby was holding both her children close to her. Ingram, with a wide grin on his face, was still holding a smoking pistol.
Are you folks all right in here?
Yes, we're fine. Thanks to you three gentlemen.
And the shotgun guard.
I've taken the trip to Sheridan many times. I've never known the Indians to be so bold. I have no idea what might have provoked them to such a thing.
When they rolled into Damaris Springs 2 hours later, several people noticed that there were arrows sticking out of the side of the coach. They followed the stage as it pulled into the depot.
What happened, Bo?
What happened? We was attacked by Indians, that's what happened. But we run them heathens off.
Yeah, we killed five of them while we was running them off.
You killed five of them, did you, Hank?
Hank climbed down from his shotgun perch.
No, far as I know, I only got one. Buffalo Bill, Falcon McAllister, and Mr. Ingram got the others.
Buffalo Bill is here?
Yep, he's in the coach.
Are you sure it was Indians and not just some bandits dressed like Indians?
They was Indians, all right. There ain't no doubt about that.
Cody and Falcon stepped out of the stage.
That's Buffalo Bill, all right! Buffalo Bill! What are you doing here?
Well, I'm here to show my friends where my new town is to be built, young man.
Is that right? Does Bellefontaine know about that?
More to the point, will he approve of it?
I have not discussed this with Mr. Bellefontaine, and to be honest, I don't care whether he approves of it or not. My business dealings are with Thornton Beck, not Pierre Bellefontaine. 5 minutes later, smiling broadly, Davis and Regret were in Bellefontaine's office. The Frenchman was a tall, slender man with silver hair and light blue eyes. He was exceptionally well-dressed, and he looked like the wealthy entrepreneur that he was.
Did you hear about the stagecoach from Sheridan getting attacked?
I heard. Are you boys responsible for that?
No, sir. This attack was for real. What we've been doing is working. We've been stirring folks up, and the engine war has started.
It is good that it has started. Now we need to keep it going.
We're working on that. I've got a line on some guns that we're gonna sell to the engines.
The army'll have to come in here then.
And once the army comes in, the whole valley will be cleared out. Engines, prospectors, homesteaders, a lot of them.
Bellefontaine smiled and took down a bottle of good blended whiskey. He poured 3 glasses, then handed one to each of the other 2 men. He held his glass up.
Gentlemen, to our success.
To our success.
The next morning, Mayor Joe Cravens presided over a town meeting in the community center to discuss the growing Indian problem. The meeting, though chaired by the mayor, saw Pierre Bellefontaine in a seat at the head table. Falcon, Cody, and Ingram sat in the front row alongside Bo and Hank. Mayor Cravens stepped to the podium.
Now, friends, I reckon you know why we've called this meeting. The truth is, this Indian problem is beginning to get out of hand. First off, we had some prospectors killed, and it was plain that it was Indians that done it. Then we had a rancher, Frank Barlow, and his whole family, good people they were, get killed by Indians too. And all of them were scalped, including even the woman and the boy. Mr. Bellefontaine has something he wants to say to us now. Mr. Bellefontaine?
Thank you, Joe. As most of you know, after the incident where the Barlow family was slaughtered by the heathens, I authorized a posse to go after the Indians. Some of you may think that, as a private citizen, I have no right to do this. But I have several employees who are required to work all up and down the valley between here and the Crow camp. I have their safety in mind. I also have the safety in mind of all the independent prospectors, homesteaders, ranchers, and farmers who are trying to live peacefully out there. To that end, I am proposing to pay $100 to any prospector who will abandon the valley, and $500 to any rancher or farmer now living out there who will give up his land.
Where are we going to get that kind of money to pay those people to do that?
Do not misunderstand me, my friends. I am not asking the town to come up with that money. I will personally supply the money to pay people to leave.
That's real decent of you, Mr. Bellefontaine, but I know for a fact that there are some ranchers and farmers out there who won't think that's enough. Fact is, I don't think you could pay some of them to come out.
Whether they stay or come out, the trouble has started. If any of you have contact with any of these people, please let them know that the offer is there.
Why don't we call in the army?
Funny that you should bring that up, for I am indeed calling in the army, and I am going to ask them to relocate the Crow. They have shown by their actions that they are not peaceful. Yesterday, they were so bold as to attack a stagecoach. It's one thing to get all the settlers out of the valley, but the way I see it, that's not even enough. With the Crow on the warpath, not even our town is safe.
It wasn't Crow that attacked the stagecoach.
I beg your pardon. And who are you?
The name is McAllister. Falcon McAllister.
Falcon McAllister?
I've heard of McAllister.
He's nigh as famous as Buffalo Bill his own self.
Well, Mr. McAllister, your name seems to have evoked some response from the citizens of Damaris Springs. I apologize for my ignorance, but I must confess that I have never heard of you.
No reason why you should have heard of me.
Tell me, why do you say that it was not the Crow who attacked the stagecoach?
I was on the stagecoach. I saw them. They were not Crow. They were Cheyenne.
They were Cheyenne, you say. And tell me, Mr. McAllister, Am I to believe that you are so knowledgeable about such things that you can tell the difference between one heathen and another?
I brought one of the arrows that was sticking out of the stage.
Falcon reached under the chair, grabbed the arrow, and held it up. Then he pointed to the markings just before the feathers.
This crooked black and yellow line here on the arrow shaft is the mark of the Crooked Lance Warrior Society. And that's Cheyenne.
He's right. I've seen the mark of the Crooked Lance Warrior Society myself. If that's what's on that arrow, then the Indians that attacked the stage was Cheyenne, not Crow.
It was Crow that attacked the Barley family, though.
Order! Order! Folks, we can't conduct this town meeting unless we have order. Now, perhaps we can get on with the meeting. Mr. Bellefontaine, you may continue.
Bellefontaine waited a moment before he resumed.
Perhaps, Mr. McAllister, you are correct. In fact, I am willing to accept that you probably are correct, as you seem to know about such things. But even if they are Cheyenne, that just broadens the picture and makes our own position here more untenable. You see, that attack happened well east of Damaris Springs, whereas the prospectors and the tragedy that befell the Barlow family happened west of us. It may well be that there has been an alliance made between the Crow and the Cheyenne, and if that is the case, we are caught in the middle.
The Crow and the Cheyenne are enemies. Now, I don't live out here anymore, but even I know that.
You say they are enemies, and they may have been so in the past. But perhaps you have not heard of this new movement that has begun among the Indians out here. It is called spirit talking, which I am led to believe is a new kind of religion. I am also told that this heathen religion seems to have reached out beyond tribal lines and is infecting all of the Indians.
Buffalo Bill held up his hand.
May I speak, Mr. Mayor?
Yes, of course, Mr. Cody.
Falcon McAllister and I are well aware of the spirit-talking movement. Indeed, that's why we're out here. I was summoned to a meeting with General Miles at his headquarters in Chicago. There, he asked me to meet personally with Sitting Bull in order to ascertain, one, whether Sitting Bull was behind this movement, and two, whether this movement represented the potential outbreak of a new Indian war. I am pleased to report that Sitting Bull has nothing to do with it, and I think the answer to the Indian question is a simple one. So long as philanthropists are allowed to weep over the Indians while politicians plunder them, while the Indian agency fails on their promise of decent treatment, there will be trouble. What we should do is make them feel that we will deal with them honestly and fairly, and that they will be held accountable for their crimes as individuals and not be held accountable as an entire tribe. When we can do that, I believe that the Indian difficulties will be at an end.
Order! Order! We can't get nothing done if y'all keep flying off the handle one way or the other. Now settle down. I don't want to have any of you thrown out of here.
After the town meeting, Bellefontaine invited Falcon, Cody, and Ingram to his office. The conference room in his office was as large as the meeting hall had been, and a big window on the west side of his office afforded a magnificent view of the snow-peaked Absarika Mountains. There were comfortable chairs and sofas throughout, buffalo skin rugs on the floor, and elk heads and antlers on the walls.
I hope you enjoy this modest libation. It is a fine wine that I import from France.
Bellefontaine passed goblets around to all of them. Then they each took a swallow.
I'll bet none of you have ever tasted anything this good, have you?
Oh, it is quite a good wine. But I prefer the Beaujolais from the vineyards in the Pierre Doré region. I had quite a good conversation with the vintner while I was there.
Oh, well, yes. Beaujolais is quite good as well.
Are you really planning on calling in the army?
Yes. I cannot be expected to continue to supply posses to take care of the Indians when, by rights, that should be the job of the army.
I agree you have no business sending out posses. But if these are isolated incidents, don't you think calling in the army would make it even worse?
What would you propose?
I would say we follow Mr. Cody's suggestion, that we call a meeting with the Crow and tell him that we do not hold the entire tribe responsible for these atrocities, but only those who actually committed them. It is my belief that the Indians would turn the guilty parties over to us.
And what makes you believe that?
The Crow have been friendly with the white man for some time now. It simply doesn't make sense that they would suddenly start making war.
That's because you don't know anything about the spirit-talking movement. Ever since they started on that, the Indians have gone crazy. Crazy, I tell you.
Have there been any incidents here in town?
No, nothing here in town. But I understand the town that you wish to build will be even closer to the Crow Reservation.
A little closer, yes.
If you are asking my advice, Cody, I would say don't build it.
Would you? Well, I'm not asking for your advice.
Are you sure he can be trusted?
Yeah. The deal was, he was to show up alone. That means there's two of us and only one of him. If anyone's worried, it should be him.
But what if he ain't alone?
He's got to come that way.
Davis pointed down toward a wide open plain.
If there's anyone with him within a mile, we'll see him.
Yeah, yeah. I guess you're right.
The two men were waiting for their meeting in an area known as Coulter's Hell on Rattlesnake Mountain in Wyoming Territory. They were here to carry out the next part of their plan to maintain the momentum of the growing Indian problem. But it was also a plan that entailed a great deal of risk, such as the risk they were taking today in meeting with Mean to his horses. If the plan failed, it could cost them their lives.
Are you sure D-Pro will come up with the guns?
You heard him, same as I did. Last time we talked to him, he said he already had the guns.
Do you believe him?
Yeah, I believe him. Don't you?
I guess. The only thing is, if we promise Mean to his horses that we're gonna furnish him with guns and we don't, it's gonna make him pretty mad.
Yeah, well, if we don't get the guns, we'll just stay away from him.
How long we been waiting here?
I don't know. An hour. Maybe two.
Maybe he ain't gonna come.
Oh, he'll come all right.
What makes you so sure?
Because he wants those weapons.
Which we ain't got with us, I'll just remind you.
We don't want the weapons with us when we first meet. Else he might just up and take them.
How's he gonna do that? You said he was coming alone.
He's supposed to, and I believe he will, but just in case he don't come alone, our best bet is not to have the weapons with us. Hey, look out there. Ain't that him?
Davis pointed. Looking in the direction Davis pointed out, Regret saw a lone rider coming toward him. Even though he was some distance away, they knew it was an Indian. And as he drew closer, they saw his face painted red on one side and white on the other.
That's him. Let's go meet him.
Wait until he gets a little closer.
The two men watched the Indian as he rode across the last 300 yards. Then, when he was within 100 yards of them, they rode out from the tree line where they'd been waiting and started toward him. First Davis and then Regret held up their right hands as they approached him. Mean to his horses held up his right hand as well.
Hello, Chief. It's good of you to come.
You have guns to sell?
Yes.
How many guns you have?
Many guns, and I can get many more.
I will buy.
With gold. I'm only going to deal in gold.
In gold?
Then we have a deal.
Where are the guns?
I'll deliver them to you. I didn't bring them with me until I knew we'd have a deal. Where's the gold?
You will have gold when I have guns.
Why, Mean to his horses. You mean you don't trust the white man?
You will get gold when I get guns.
All right. I go along with that.
Why?
Why what?
You are white. I'm Indian. If you sell guns, I will make war on the white man. Why do you sell?
I think the white man has done the Indian wrong. I'll sell the guns to you because I want to see justice done.
I think you lie.
What?
I think you sell guns because you want the gold I will give you. And you do not care if I make war on the whites.
You're pretty smart, Injun. You're right. I want the gold.
Mean to his horses nodded, and then he looked toward the tree line near where Davis and Regret had waited for him. He held his hands in the air, and four mounted Indians emerged from the woods, riding toward him.
What the hell? Where did they come from?
Mean to his horses, just smile. Angus Ebersole, Clay Hawkins, Ike Peters, Jim Dewey, and Billy Taylor sat in the Fireman's Exchange Saloon, having just arrived in Sheridan on board the North Mist riverboat. Relatively flush, having the money they took from the bank plus the money they got from selling their horses to the army, they lounged around the table drinking and planning their next move.
I wish old Pelham had been here with his camera so he could have took a picture of Slayton when McAllister stood him down.
Yeah, we could hang it up on the wall here so Slayton would see it every time he come in.
Maybe there ain't no picture, but don't forget the writer fella that was with them. And I'd sure like to read what he wrote about. I seen him writing something no sooner than Slayton went out of here with his tail tucked up between his legs, like as if he was a beat dog or something.
Yeah, I've heard tell that the biggest reason McAllister and Buffalo Bill are famous in the first place is because that writer fella made them famous. Can't think of his name, though.
His name is Ingram, Prentice Ingram, and he's a real good writer. I've read some of his books.
The bartender examined the glass and started polishing.
Ha! I wonder if Slayton will turn up in any of his books.
Excuse me, gents. This here McAllister feller you're talking about, would that be Falcon McAllister?
It would indeed. Do you know him?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I do. He's an old friend of mine. But who is this gentleman Slayton you are talking about?
Slayton ain't no gentleman, mister. And that is for sure and certain. He ain't nothing but a bully. You see Lucy's eye there? House black? Slayton done that to her.
But he got his comeuppance. Slayton thinks he's pretty good with a gun. Only as it turns out, he wasn't good enough to go against McAllister.
McAllister kill him, did he?
Kill him? Nah, he didn't kill him, and that's just what makes it so good. McAllister just stood him down, made Slayton chuck out of his gun belt and leave it here.
His gun is still here. It's there behind the bar. Show it to him, Jake.
Jake, the bartender, held the gun up.
Here it is. Only thing is, Slayton ain't got the gall to come back for it.
My, my, I wish I had been here to see that.
Ebersole turned to his table.
Don't you boys think that would have been a good show to see? McAllister standing down Slayton?
At first, Dewey and the others didn't know what the hell Ebersole was getting at. They certainly would not have enjoyed seeing McAllister in a heroic role. But seeing the expression in Ebersole's face, they knew to go along with him.
It wasn't just a show. Mr. McAllister came to my aid when Slayton began hitting me.
That's true. McAllister wasn't just showing off or nothing like that. Slayton deserved what happened to him.
Where is he now?
Who, Slayton? Like as not, he's still down at the livery. He works there. Don't reckon we'll see him back here very soon.
No, I mean Falcon McAllister. Like I said, he's an old friend of mine, and I'd like to look him up. Is he still in town?
Nah, he ain't here no more. He left. Him and Buffalo Bill and that rider. Hell, that was really something in itself, wasn't it? I mean, Falcon McAllister and Buffalo Bill, both here at the same time.
They didn't stay here long, though.
Couldn't stay too long. Buffalo Bill's having a big audition up in Cinnabar.
What kind of audition? What are you talking about?
Why, you know about Buffalo Bill, don't you? He has a Wild West show. Of course, I ain't ever seen it, because mostly he plays it back east, like in New York, in Philadelphia, and St. Louis and the like.
In London and Paris and Vienna, too.
Yeah. His show has bronco busting and stagecoach driving, all sorts of things like that. And it's done made him one of the richest men in the country.
And the cowboys that work for him makes good money, too. That's why there will be so many showing up in Cinnabar trying to get signed on to his show.
Where is Cinnabar?
Oh, it's just north of Yellowstone Park. Why, you planning on trying out for the show?
Who knows? I might be interested. When is this audition being held?
It's a week from tomorrow. It was printed up by the newspaper. Lucy, show them a newspaper article about the audition.
Lucy walked down to the end of the bar, then brought a copy of the Sheridan Bulletin over to show Ebersole.
And you say that McAllister went to Cinnabar with Buffalo Bill?
Yeah, Only they didn't go right there. They took a stagecoach from here to Demerara Springs. Buffalo Bill, McAllister, and that rider feller that's traveling with them.
Ingram! The rider is named Prentice Ingram.
Yeah, Ingram. Anyhow, the word I heard is the Buffalo Bill's going to build himself a town there. Yeah, well, not right in where Demerara Springs is, but real close.
Like as not, it'll be the end of Demerara Springs.
That's probably right. And get this. He's going to name it after himself.
Yes, well, if I had as much money as Buffalo Bill Cody, I'd like as not build me a town, too. And I'd name it after myself, too. I'd call it Hickenlooper.
Finishing their drinks, Ebersole and the others left the saloon and walked down Central Street to the livery stable. A man came out of the stable to meet them. He was a big man with stubble on his chin and irregular, yellowed, broken, and missing teeth.
Yeah, what do you want?
Do you have horses for sale?
Horses for sale? Yeah, we got horses.
Good. We'll need five.
Five? I don't know as I could sell you five. That'd pretty near clean us out. You have to wait till Mr. Giles comes back.
Is your name Slayton?
Yeah. How do you know that?
I've heard you are pretty good with a gun, Slayton.
Yeah, I ain't bad.
I've also heard that you don't care much for a man named Falcon McAllister.
Are you trying to be funny, mister? Because I don't like it when folks try to fun me.
No, I'm not trying to be funny at all. In fact, I will tell you why we want these horses. We are on McAllister's trail, and we plan to kill him.
You plan to kill him?
We do. McAllister and Buffalo Bill Cody.
And that rider, son of a bitch, traveling with him.
Why? Why are you gonna kill him?
Does it make any difference why? As I understand it, you may have a bone to pick with him as well. I would think you would welcome the idea that we're gonna kill him.
Slayton was silent for a long moment.
Any of you fellas got an extra gun?
Why do you ask?
Because my gun and holster is still in the saloon. And I ain't going back in there to get it and be made a fool of.
There's a gun shop here. I seen it when we got off the boat.
Well, I ain't gonna go buy one either for the same reason. But I'll make you a deal.
What kind of a deal?
One of you fellas will go buy a gun for me. I'll give you these five horses for free.
What? How are you going to do that?
Oh, because Giles is going down to Laramie. And by the time he gets back, we and his horses will be long gone.
We?
Yeah, that's part of the deal. I'm going with you.